As technology marches on, what kind of world are we moving towards? According to AEI senior fellow Jim Pethakoukas, it's an abundant and prosperous one, at least potentially. So long as we play our cards right and embrace what he calls upwing technology and growth policies, we will reap the benefits of what many find to be destabilizing, disorienting change. This week on Hardly Working, Brent speaks with Pethakoukas about his book, The Conservative Futurist, How to Create the Sci-Fi World We Were Promised, and how we can best manage the steps toward this upwing future.
Jim Pethakoukas, thanks for joining us on Hardly Working.
Brent, I appreciate you having me on.
Well, I've been looking forward to this. I really, really enjoyed your new book, and I'm interested in getting into that quickly, but I also want to know more about you than I currently know. Like, how did the world shape Jim Pethakoukas? Where did you come from? Who would you say are the big influences in your life and your thinking?
Well, I'm from the Chicago area, Chicago suburbs, kind of a working class neighborhood. Someone who sort of has always had an interest in the wider world. I always would bother my father to come back with at least both the Tribune and Sun Times every day, starting about age 8, and just kind of read them cover to cover. And
we were raised by similar men then, because we had 2 daily newspapers delivered to our house. You know, it's like that very text-rich environment. So important.
Yeah, and he was a great lover of current events and loved talking about politics. Uh-huh. And so I guess I kind of got the bug for like current events, probably from him. Mm-hmm. But I can say that, and I went to Northwestern University and I wrote for the conservative, you know, paper on campus, you know, the one that on Fridays mm-hmm. the liberal kids would take and throw into the garbage. Mm-hmm. Like, it was that paper.
Yeah, we had one of those at the U of O too, at the University of Oregon. It was called The Commentator, and everybody just called it The Commie Hater.
So, that's excellent. Yeah. But I'll tell you, there was a, and when I've answered this question before, it's actually very easy for me to like to pinpoint like a particular book that really got me interested in sort of the American economy and how that economy is different than other economies and how it really shaped America's place in the world. It was a book called The Third Century by Joel Kotkin, who remains an important public intellectual in this country. And it was a time when Japan was sort of really rising. People thought it would eventually become the most important, largest economy in the world. I think by like the late 80s, if you looked at like the 20 largest companies in the world, 15 were Japanese companies. And there were certainly a lot of American politicians saying that they have figured out a newer, better model for economic growth. And this book said, and this book came out probably, I think maybe 88, so it was really right before the Japanese economy stalled out, so great timing. But it said that there's something special about the American economy, that because of our free enterprise system and our entrepreneurs, that we had, I think the Japanese word, and I apologize if I goof it up, I think it was called like Sokojihara, which meant reserve strength, that we had this great reserve strength because of our entrepreneurs, and that would serve America very well for the rest of the 20th century and going into the 21st century. And that's exactly what happened. America had a fantastic 90s and into the early 2000s, and while there's been trouble since then, if I look around, the most important country in the world economically is America. We have the most important technology sector, we have the most important technology companies, and the recent advances we've seen, you know, not with AI, but across sectors, from genetic editing, you know, biotechnology and space and energy, these tend to be American companies, American innovators, not just, but mostly. And I think that is because of our free enterprise system. So that's kind of how I got here.
So that's a good segue into the book, The Conservative Futurist, and I That's a very clever title. Congratulations. And wedding
title number 7.
Yeah. and it's clever because of the way it pairs two ideas which are often cast in opposition to one another. You can't be both a conservative and hopeful about the future, because conservatives are about conserving, about trying to sustain what is good and best in society, and it's sometimes it seems like that instinct is at war with a free market economy in which things are always changing. They never stop changing. So tell me how you put those two things together in your mind.
I've generally found that the critics of the book come in two flavors. One, people who don't like what they typically call sort of the neoliberal, what I would say is about economic openness, in many cases fundamental economics flavor to the books. Those tend to be people probably on the further left. But on the right, they don't like the conservative part, that I would use the word conservative to describe this vision. And when I hear them talk about it, to me, and I'm sure it's not their intention, to me it's almost like a really cartoonish version of conservatism, which is a sort of a fear of change, at best a love of the status quo, but really at worst, and it's in there, a real nostalgia for a very specific kind of America that they think once existed and was better.
Which they never themselves actually experienced.
No.
They're just looking back and imagining an America that was better because it was simpler. But they never actually lived there. And many of them, if they were transported back in time, probably wouldn't find it all that comfortable.
They would not. And I often, when most of my kids were smaller and we lived near my boyhood home, every once in a while we'd have a reason to be in that neighborhood, and I'd take a drive by, and they thought that I lived in the poorest, most broken down neighborhood in a hovel of a house, that's certainly not what I felt like back then. I thought like this is like totally fine, right? Mm-hmm. But I certainly would not want to go live back in that no AC TV with 3 channels, 2,000 square foot unfinished basement house. I would not,
I have the same. I have the same feeling when I drive by my childhood home and I look at it, and I can't get over how small it was. This was for the first generation of American homeowners, which owning a home was democratized, right? And people, so it was very, very basic, and now it looks incredibly run down. Even though at the time, of course, as you say, you're not thinking, oh, we're kind of lower middle class here. You know, that's essentially
I knew that there were kids at school who lived in like better neighborhoods and nicer homes. But for some reason, like, I didn't feel, it didn't make me feel worse. All I know is I liked hanging out at their house.
Yeah.
But so I think there's a lot of that. But yeah. I think what it comes down to, I think you alluded to, is sort of what, okay, you're saying conservative. That's the word I chose. What am I conserving? Like, mm-hmm. Am I conserving? There's lots of things I could be conserving. I could be conserving a certain kind of family arrangement. I could be wanting to conserve or go back to a certain kind of demographic makeup of that country. So that would be not conserving what we have today, but going back and trying to restore something. So what am I conserving exactly? And again, people are going to have different definitions of conservatism. And right now, there's certainly a battle, maybe a losing battle from my perspective, of what that word means and what people should think. But I think what I'm conserving is the best of what got us here, with the best that a world that at one point countries were not democracies, a world that did not have these kind of thriving entrepreneurial market economies where people could start a business and create a new product and no one would shut them down and they could become rich. Like, that always wasn't the world. It used to be like with the guilds, or you would go to the king or queen and say, this product will put people out of business or put me out of business, and they would quash you. And of course, you know, there was no democracy at all. So that transformation to a world of liberal democracy and free market capital, like, those are two important legacies that I want to conserve that and then use that as a foundation to build, I hope, a more prosperous, free, opportunity-laden tomorrow. And I find that definition, some people don't like because they feel it's material, but that's not their version of conservatism.
So I'm trying to make the best argument I can against what you're saying, and it's hard because I agree fundamentally with what you're saying, but I think that thoughtful opponents of your outlook might say something like, so Jim, what's the limiting principle here? What's the limiting principle, particularly as it relates to changes in technology or in patterns of living that erode human dignity? You know, is all change good? Is there any way that we can thoughtfully sort of guide and direct it, or do we just have to sort of get on the train and see where it goes?
Well, I think fundamentally, we have gotten on the train broadly and seen how it goes, but not in all cases. We have rules against people owning atomic weapons. Mm. We try to make sure countries we think shouldn't have atomic weapons don't have atomic weapons. So I mean, so there on nuclear technology, that would be a limiting principle. What I find interesting is that what we've been really good at is coming up with limiting principles and constraints. We seem to be very, very good at that. And I, you know, I've gotten that question. And when you look at the world around, do you see a world of unchecked technological progress, or do you see technology which has had limiting principles applied to it, whether it's the use of embryos, whether it's nuclear power? And we have been in this new world of generative AI for about, I don't know, 15 months, and we are such a freewheeling, anything goes culture that after about 15 minutes of this technology being known, we had people calling for pauses and brand new regulations. So it seems to me,
whole new departments.
Whole new departments. And if you think this is a technology that will infiltrate all aspects of life, to control this technology is to regulate the entire economy and all our lives. So I guess so the book is about, at this point, moving beyond the sort of constraints which we have been applying to ourselves for half a century. I think it will be hard enough to minimize constraints going forward. So my book is more about like how we can deal with like a constraint saturated culture, which I think has meant a world of more poverty, more fear, certainly fear about tomorrow, a world of more pain and suffering than is necessary. So far, I think that is what the constraints have gotten us. And look, if these technologies, and you know, just talk about AI since it's the hot thing in the news. I was speaking to a group of students and someone, and I think these were kids who were working on Capitol Hill, and they were asking me something about AI and credit scores. And what are you going to do about that? I'm like, well, you might as well, if this is technology that's going to affect every industry, there are a million questions like about how companies will use it. And we will, like anything else, we will have to figure it out. And I think we will figure it out. But to sit here right now in 2024 and say like, and create some sort of mass regulatory anticipatory framework for this technology, that is really placing a lot of confidence on our ability to understand today and understand what this technology will do tomorrow. I don't think it's capable. I don't think we're capable.
The predictions are hard, especially about the future.
Always about the future, tricky.
Yeah, very tricky.
Put a number and a date, never both.
Yep. So you quote a, or not quote, you paraphrase a an economist, Hyman Minsky, I think was the name, saying stability can be destabilizing. Can you unpack that a little bit? How can stability be destabilizing?
I think you really see this argument play out with people who are in favor of trade protectionism, protecting industries through tariffs so they don't face foreign competition. They worry about people losing their jobs. That's very traumatic on a family. I certainly know that. My mother lost her job at the time. She was the sole breadwinner. Extremely traumatic. What happens to entire communities? So there's like a natural impulse, and I think there's also a natural psychological impulse toward caution, toward preserving the status quo.
It's risk aversion, right? I mean,
it's a true cognitive bias.
We fear what we might lose more than we value what we can't see that we might gain.
So that's a vote for stability. We're gonna create stability, but of course, the rest of the world doesn't go away, and because this company doesn't have to compete with anybody else, at least for a while, with the rest of the world, all of a sudden they find out that their products aren't so competitive with the rest of the world. And all of a sudden, that company is a troubled company. Maybe it'll go for the government for a bailout. Who knows? But most likely, that company is going to shrink. That company is going to have to lay off people. They will become a nub. I mean, you can just look at something like the American steel industry and the Gary Steelworks, something I'm a little familiar with being from Chicago in Indiana. So the vote for stability actually created tremendous long-term instability in the lives of those people, in the lives of that city that they've never actually recovered. So it is a real, it is a myth, because too often that vote for stability is just a vote for stability over the short term, and long term you have set yourself up for a chaotic situation.
Have you given any thought to how we buffer human beings against the not to try to prevent the change, but to create buffers for people so that they can adapt to change?
I find that the answer to that question, and whether it people who are some people who tend to be very concerned about the impact of a dynamic economy where there's, another economic phrase, creative destruction, which sounds like a heartless phrase to some people. When you talk about, okay, we're going to create a safety net, and whether it is, job retraining or, income subsidies or wage subsidies for people, they just really view that as a half measure that doesn't erase the possibility of the change itself is so chaotic and so disruptive that those things just aren't enough, and it's just better. And unless you're going to go all the way to something like a basic income, so people can decide whether to work or not, but there's a lot of space between where we are now and a basic income. And certainly here at AI, we've done a lot of work on buffering that and trying to make sure that people have a standard of living which we as a society think is minimally adequate. And
I just think it's almost more about how do we support adaptation, because that seems to be ultimately the biggest challenge. It isn't like, all right, we're going to replace your lost income. It should be more about we're going to resource you so that you can find the pathway to the next thing, rather than you're now you're just not relevant anymore. We're just going to set you aside and move on, and we're just going to put you on a shelf and send you your disability check.
But I think there needs, and this is, you know, I have seven kids, and if there's one message about, you know, careers, is you should be prepared to change.
Yeah.
That you shouldn't feel like, I like this job, and most people don't want this, but you should always be thinking about your skills and your education. Keep that resume fresh. Mm-hmm. The myth that somehow that job can be stable, there are too many forces. No matter how good a job you do, other things could affect that company. And you should be at some level preparing yourself for change. So I think most people probably do have that expectation, but I think there's a lot of people who don't.
So what do you tell your kids in terms of what's the best preparation for developing that kind of adaptive framework for themselves?
I tell them you should anticipate to always be learning something, whether it's formally at a school or whether it's taking some online class, that you should not view yourself as a completed work. And I have most of my kids are in that sort of in their 20s. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of interesting conversations about about what I believe and what they should be doing. And it's it can be very unsettling, because you would love for someone to outline what that path is. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And if you're lucky enough to be the kids who's lucky enough to think of, oh, I've always wanted to be a doctor, that's what I want to do, there's a very set mm-hmm. path. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, even for that kid.
Even for that.
You know what? People change their minds. I mean, mm-hmm. what you like at age, 22 might not be like what your age at 32. Look how many people who are like, I'm going to be an attorney, and that's what I want to be. And there's mm-hmm. whole websites devoted to people who've abandoned the law, who realize right. that it's not all arguing, right. In front of the Supreme Court. And now what am I going to do with this degree? So things change, and you have to sort of, at some level, be prepared for it.
So in terms of academic preparation, it sounds like you would lean more toward, I think you did graduate work at the University of Chicago. Is that right?
I did not.
You did not? Okay. No. All right. My mistake.
I've also stressed that, while I went to college and I got a master's degree in journalism, not something I would easily advise people to do also from Northwestern. Mm-hmm. I have a real bias, and working in journalism at a think tank, toward college, and I've sort of soaked in that world and with people who have graduate degrees, so I have so much respect for the scholars here that I have a real bias, but I'm saying that's not what you necessarily need to do. I think I hope I've been open enough with my own kids that that there may be a mm-hmm. different path forward. Mm-hmm. You need to move down that path, mm-hmm. and that path will require some sort of education, and you need to be prepared for that.
So what are they studying? You've got a few in college right now, right?
I currently have none
in college.
I will have, I think, another one in college in another 18 months or so. There was a long period where I had four in college at the same time. It's a variety of things: computer science, English, economics and statistics. So it's been a wide variety of things. One thing, and this is probably more about my family than anyone really is interested in, but the one thing I tried to stress is if you want to take something, if you want to have a major in something that's not like obviously applicable to the real world, that's totally fine. But if you can, let's take something else that seems mm-hmm. more applicable. So I have one like art/computer science major who decided to follow that. So that must have been very vexing for her, using both sides of her brain all the time. But some of them they've listened to the advice. Some haven't. And we'll see how it all works out for them.
Yeah, right?
We'll see how it all. There, it's early. If you would have asked me, if you looked at my life when I was 24, I could not have predicted where I'd be at 30. So a lot of change.
But I think in the midst of that, you really put your finger on something. I heard Nouriel Roubini say on a I think it was a McKinsey and Company podcast, you know, like he was kind of dooming and glooming the future of work. And they said, well, what should we tell people to do? And he said, you got to treat education like an investment. And what do you do with your investments? You diversify your portfolio so that if it goes down one area, it may be going up in another area. So get this sort of, you know, if you're great in the sciences, be sure to pick up some humanities and social sciences. If you are conversely great in the humanities, make sure that you are paying attention to the development of scientific knowledge, because you just don't know. And this creates this balanced portfolio of being able to.
It's a long term portfolio.
Yeah.
You'll be building on this foundation for decades and decades, and maybe, you know, if we're all living to 120, many, many decades. So you really. You're so busy in your 20s, and maybe you've just started a job, and you know, now you're like, oh, do I need to go back to school? And you know, and you know, maybe you're thinking like, oh, you know, when do I want to, you know, start a family? Late 20s, I got to fit this all in. Just remember that any investment that you make in your education, like you will be drawing upon that one way or another for a long, long time. So it's a worthwhile investment, because even though maybe you're only thinking about the next 5 years, it really is part of a broad 50-year plan. And you don't know where you'll be going over those 50 years,
right.
but it's probably helpful if you know more.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
Good. Now I have affirmation. That,
yeah.
I'm crazy, so I can, I can bring you into the conversation.
Yeah. Just tell them that.
I'm the right guy at work. He said you nailed. I nailed it. I absolutely nailed it.
Okay, you mentioned AI, and this is an area that I'm really interested in from the future of work standpoint. Where do you think artificial intelligence, how does it figure in your thinking about the potential for advancement, growth, future of the economy? There's a lot of things that are going to influence that, right? We're really focused on this AI question right now because it's new, it's the hot thing. But what's your thinking when you look across all of the inputs that are creating a dynamic economy or contributing to the dynamism of our economy? Where do you think AI fits?
Well, I would hope that it turns out to be worthy of all the conversation that we've been giving it, particularly, you know, ChatGPT and OpenAI and some of the other models and chatbots that we've been giving it over for the past, 15 months or whatever. Because if it is, then it is an absolute blessing. It will allow us to break out of what has been mostly a period of, I think, surprisingly slow economic growth and technological progress. And what does that mean? That means we're not as rich as we could be. We're not as healthy as what we could be. There are more poor people in the world than there need to be. And not just, and again, not just like, you know, in this country. What I think we should say to the, you know, to people, the poorest people in the world is, it's okay to aspire. It's okay to aspire that the poorest parts of the world can be as rich as the richest parts of the world today, where some people say, like, we can't do that because
right,
we don't know how to do that.
Yeah. That would require three and a half Earths.
Right. It would require three and a half Earths. So I think, we should hope that this is a technology worthy of the amount of time we're spending on it, because it could mean, at worst, that we found something as powerful as what we saw with, you know, the combination of the PC and the internet, but maybe more so. Maybe it's just a sort of a step change in innovation that will allow us to grow at least as fast in the future as we have in the past, which would be about 50% faster than what most experts think right now. And there certainly will be challenges, you know, and companies will rise and fall, jobs will change, jobs will go away, there will be new jobs. All the changes that we've sort of gone through in the past, and yet we're still here. So
the power of the technology is, from my perspective, I'm interested in hearing what you think, is that economic dynamism has always been a function of our capacity to know more things and have greater access to information and to be able to organize that information toward productive ends. Do you agree that that's the fundamental benefit that we might derive from AI? Like, that's the thing that spreads out across the economy.
Right. You're applying intelligence to all areas of the economy in a way that we've not been able to do before, because any one person can only know so much. But now imagine that you can have, you know, an expert, an absolute expert in a certain field, be working with you every day. Whether it's working at a bank, whether you're a scientist, and now you can have a research assistant who will never tire. Who will never,
I have those already.
Some of us are lucky enough to pluck those out of American university system. But everybody will have access to those. And, one of the probable obstacles toward progress is there's just a lot to know out there and to keep track of. And to be at the top of your profession requires even more education. Just take AI. Every day, I look at different sites which track new papers on generative AI and these large language models. And there's papers from all over the world, dozens and dozens. I myself could never keep track, but I could have an AI that would know the kinds of things I'm particularly interested in and help me keep track in a way that it would take a team of assistants to do. So I think ultimately it's about applying tireless intelligence to just about every task, hopefully in the process not only making us more productive at what we currently do, but create new things for us to do. I think that's the promise. And if that promise can be fulfilled, I think a lot of the book is about I talk about the 50s and 60s and sort of the dreams, but we don't have to go back that far. We should just go back to like the late 1990s, where you had a new technology, tons of investment, the economy going up, stock market going up, wages going up, unemployment falling. And it was not a period where people were in fear of the future, because they could see in a very tangible way that their lives were improving. If you look at the Gini chart of inequality, inequality was going up, but there were not mass protests outside of Goldman Sachs or outside of Yahoo, complaining about you're disrupting this economy because things are. So I feel somewhat confident that if people see their everyday lives improving, that these concerns about the future and disruption won't quite be as prominent as perhaps what we worry about right now.
So Jim, let's talk a little bit about this behemoth that we live inside of here in Washington, D.C., this thing we call the federal government that is has come to permeate over decades just about every aspect of American life. How is government going to either enable or inhibit the possibilities of the future that your book talks about?
Well, in the book, I write about what went wrong. Why are all these the dreams I've described of being richer and healthier, not to mention being able to vacation at the Lunar One base, all that kind of stuff. why didn't that happen? And there's lots of macro reasons that we can point to about, you know, that it's there's just so much more knowledge. It takes longer to climb that tree of knowledge. And, you know, these great inventions of the second part of the Industrial Revolution, that we sort of extracted all the big gains from electrification, the internal combustion engine, and chemicals. And so there was always probably going to be these kinds of headwinds of progress, against progress. But, like, our decisions mattered. Like, what we do matter. We're not just the victim of these sort of these vast forces and sort of the independent path of technological progress, that we made decisions that made progress and growth harder, starting in the 1970s and then right up to today. And, you know, government had a role to play in both. I think on one side, it regulated very badly. It regulated because of a concern about the environment, and there was, I think there was an assumption that growth and progress were so powerful, it almost didn't matter what we would do. Now, there were certainly some people who didn't want that, who did want to slow down, thought it was too fast. But when many of these environmental regulations were passed, which made it very hard to build, which created a sort of a cumbersome process to build in the real world. So, you know, bring in these sort of citizen activists who would have to be part of the process, and then you would have to come up with these reviews, and the reviews got longer, and then you know, things either cost too much or they took too long to build, so they weren't built, and people decided to try to innovate in other places. And people wondered, like, why do we have social media but not like fusion reactors? Well, it became a lot harder to build in the world. So part, I think, was a sort of an arrogance about what we could do even with these regulations. Certainly think some environmental regulations like air quality probably turned out to be pro-economic growth and getting lead out of gasoline and that sort of thing. People are like, well, this was like in the 70s, man. Like, now it's today. And I'm like, well, have you tried to build a high-speed rail? So these are all, like, still things which are extremely... And Democrats who would like this green energy economy, clean economy, and they want to build, you know, wind farms and solar farms and transmission lines. Now they found out, like, it's really hard. I mean... Forget about trying to install a wind turbine somewhere. Good luck building the company, the factory at the site that would build the turbine. Like, that's really hard. So I think there's been an underappreciation, though by some it was very clear almost right away that there was going to be a real problem with this onslaught of regulation in the early 70s. But apparently some people have recently figured it out. So that's something, like, it did too much of. Like, there was too much. But it also did too little of something else. And the thing it did too little of is spend good old taxpayer dollars on something that most people should agree that's a role of government, which is scientific research. I would love to see a counterfactual of what the world would look like today had, after the Apollo program, that the government had continued to invest at those levels, whether it was in some sort of new Apollo. I think
one of your favorite TV shows is in this theme.
Yes, which does show that world, which is nuclear fusion reactors by the 80s, and no one's talking about climate change anymore. I think one might be able to point that. I think there's considerable research that shows that would have accelerated progress and growth.
How do we do it? How do we, you know, we only focus on the cost side of the cost-benefit analysis. How do we build a more complete picture for people to see what they're giving up if they don't enable and approve and promote progress?
I was doing my own podcast for my Faster Please newsletter with Mark Injuries,
which is a wonderful newsletter, everybody. If you thank you aren't subscribing, it's great.
I appreciate that. And I asked I asked, you know, Andreessen and sort of the, you know, like, how does this, you know, this has been a long time where we've been fighting these problems and growth has been slower, and president after president has said we need to accelerate growth, and it kind of hasn't happened. So why should I feel positive about the future? It's like, you shouldn't. Not at all. Like, that's like, that would be, that should be your baseline, should be more of the same. Because that is a very powerful lesson. And we are so entrenched, what I call in this sort of stagnationary thinking, that it is going to be hard to change. I think there are some reasons to think that can change. I think there are some things we can do. I think by far the most obvious thing is, we've just absolutely lucked out in a way that if we have stumbled upon a technology which will accelerate growth. And if growth is accelerating, I think it's and people are seeing change in their lives, I think you will then get a more sort of risk-embracing society, because they're like, okay, it's going to disrupt things, but like, it'll be worth it. Mm-hmm. So if people don't think it's worth it, it's hard to make the case. So if actually we do see faster growth from AI, and there's a lot of estimates, and we'll see, I think that, by far, would be a
stupid. What's your instinct on that? I know that I've seen you write a few things on this. Like, we've seen a jump in productivity.
Pick them.
And there's a, you know, is that, what is that? I mean, is
it? You know, I think the expectations are everywhere from like, you know, a modest improvement to something which would allow us to grow again as fast in the decades ahead as we have since World War II. So instead of growing maybe at 1.8%, we'd grow close to, you know, 3-4%, which you know,
changes made everything.
which only seem like a percentage point, but it's like double.
Yeah.
And year after year, the compounding, certainly some people are like, it's going to be such a different technology that we can just throw out all the estimates. So I think even somewhat faster growth would be fantastic. I think it would be super helpful as a society if people weren't inundated with negative messages about tomorrow, many of which just aren't, just don't match. People who care about the science, who just don't match with the science. I watched a very star-studded, expensive TV miniseries on Apple TV Plus, called Extrapolations, which was extrapolated our future decade after decade throughout the 21st century, you know, built around climate change. And it was, you know, lots of, you know, great big actors. Meryl Streep was in it. So, and not only did it show like disaster, though, you know, we all didn't die, but disaster. And at the end, I think they were putting tech CEOs on trial. But no point did they say, you know, maybe over the next 100 years we might be able to, you know, build a, you know, a really cheap nuclear reactor
or
a fusion reactor.
Maybe that's next season.
Yeah, I don't think there is no next
season two.
There was no effort to show that we could innovate our way and deal with this.
Sounds like a project that Andreessen might be interested in.
That would be helpful. One thing that excites me about AI is that it will allow people who are not Hollywood producers to create positive, pro-progress images of the future. Whether it's people, simpletons like me who now know how to create like a cool still image, to creating little mini movies or maybe longer for very little money. I mean, so much of the focus has been on the threat to Hollywood. I don't know, we might see a flowering of film, video, and other storytelling that maybe tell a different story. I also think that there's just some tailwinds, and it seems like, you know, a replay of the Cold War. But if one impact of this rivalry with China is that people start thinking more about, you know, if there are challenges for the technological leadership of the world, well, what can we do to stay to be technological leaders? So that's like the first step. Like, oh, we should think about that. And if people then look at China and think their sort of top-down central planning approach to being a technological leader in anything other than surveillance technology, if that's not working, then it further reinforces what I think is an emphasis on what do we do really well, which is called the free enterprise system. So I think that would be a great conclusion to draw. And listen, and look around the world. To me, you can take lots of polls and look at what are people's attitudes about the future. To me, if you want to, like, you know, like in a quick snapshot, what if people think about nuclear power? If they see if the people don't like nuclear power, they're worried about all the potential downsides. These are people who are negative about the future because they're missing the science. But around the world, nuclear power is happening. Countries don't want to be reliant on Russia for natural gas. They realize that to get a cleaner future, people aren't going to live worse lives. It's going to require clean energy abundance. So I think that's a massive tailwind in and of itself. Nuclear is good, but also demonstrating the power of technology to create sort of abundance and clean energy. Oh, and by the way, we'd already be there if it wasn't for a certain group of people saying, don't do it for 50 years.
And it does seem to be kind of a bipartisan consensus in favor of progress, right? I mean, I see a lot of center-left writers who sound very much like you. You know, they're not exactly wouldn't put it exactly the same way, but, you know, who are really against NIMBYism and who are really in favor of innovation and growth and get it, you know, the Derek Thompsons and,
I think the difficulties in executing in the real world the Biden agenda, coming up against this massive sort of regulatory barrier, has been a real eye opener, as well as an understanding that, you know, people, we're not gonna just solar panel our way to a far richer world. It's going to require probably a new energy source. I think. So if you really care about the environment and are open and are non-ideological, all of a sudden you start thinking in a different way. Though, of course, there are people in both parties who think like on both sides of the aisle, across the spectrum, who think like that. But there's also people across the spectrum, usually on the further right and further left, who have so much in common. They're very worried about, you know, economic openness. They're very worried about disruption, and they're out there too. Mm-hmm. So, somebody criticized my book as being anti-politics. Far from it. There's going to be a lot of politics, both between the more pro-progress people and anti-progress people. But like, if I sat down with Derek Thompson, Ezra Klein, those two get tagged as sort of like the pro progress folks on the left. I guarantee you, they have a far more confidence in government to do things and sort of with this kind of new industrial policy. We'd have a nice debate.
So let's talk about that just for a minute. I really wanted to get your take on the Biden administration's infrastructure and other reshoring initiatives and things like that. And I just want to hear what you think of this, because at one level, right, like we're building microprocessor, plants, and we're investing in, huge amount of money in rebuilding infrastructure. Are those good things or not?
Yeah, I think, yes, I think infrastructure, again, that is something that is worth spending money on. I think the heart of a modern economy is connection, whether it's connecting people or connecting the ability to move goods. So I think that's important. I think where the problem with the Biden administration is that they believe they have figured out what the future should look like and are pressing ahead in a way that ignores what the world is telling them. And that's sorry, your hardcore people on the right don't like interested in climate change, and they're not interested in this. But there's a reason many center right people like the idea of things like carbon taxes, because if you think climate change is real, you put a tax on carbon, and then you see what happens, right? So, and maybe you'll do some scientific research for new technologies, but basically you'll see what the market produces, what will pass the market test. But that's not what the Biden administration has done. They've determined, for instance, that we should have so many electric cars by a certain year. Now, that's a plan. That is a central plan. Mm-hmm. And right now, it's clear, like, that might not work, that there might not actually be the demand. The technology might not be completely there. Do you adjust the plan, or do you double down on the plan? Mm-hmm. So we'll see what they want to do. That, you know, those subsidies may need to be bad. I suppose if you give people enough money, they will buy an electric car. But how much is that going to cost? So you were talking very earlier about limiting principles and constraints. I think one constraint is to look at, like, what is the real world actually mm-hmm. telling you about mm-hmm. your plan, and can you adjust? Mm-hmm. And it's very hard when you build your presidency around that this must be the plan, this is the way the world is going to look like. And that's a big part of, like, my conservative futurism is I'm not saying the world needs to look like this. I'm saying empower people through opportunity, through economic growth, through technology, and I will bet on what their preferences, how those play mm-hmm. out in the real world, mm-hmm. than like the Ministry of the Future or some Department of the Future in Crystal City or something, where there's on the top floor with big screens and they're moving things around, like,
and they've got a 100-year plan.
Right, a 100-year plan, yeah. And they're, you know, they got goggles on, so they're moving the plan around, like, that they'll figure out the plan. Yeah. I'm very skeptical. Yeah. that will work. Yeah. So I wish that, so we good policy making this humility.
We haven't conayed the knowledge problem that
that's
Hayek right.
Well,
talked
that's
about.
Certainly where I was going with
yeah,
this.
Yeah. Okay, let's wrap this up. And I want to do something just a little bit lighter here at the end, which is one of the things I enjoy most about your writing is how much time you spend writing about science fiction. And so for our listeners, could you give us three shows that they should be watching and three books they should be reading that are
a lot. we'll try to do some of that.
Yeah, yeah.
Again,
in the realm of fiction, right?
Yeah. So. Well, I think more of my time these days is certainly spent watching than reading. So reading science fiction, so that's a little bit easier. For watching science fiction. We are in sort of a lucky time, which there are a few things out there that aren't Star Trek. That aren't Star Trek, because there's so much out there that sometimes this pro-progress stuff sneaks through. We mentioned earlier, which is For All Mankind by Ronald D. Moore, creator of Battlestar Galactica.
Which was a pretty pessimistic show.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. Not a real fan of networking computers. Yeah. and that's a show that's about it's a alt history show that takes place in the decades starting at the space race 1960s. It's built on the simple premise of what if America lost the space race, but then the American Soviet Union decided to keep on racing? Mm-hmm. What would the world look like? I think a very well thought out show, and I like it shows a world that I think is a more interesting, better world in many ways, but not a utopia. By any, you know, there are still problems. There are still politics. Mm-hmm. That doesn't go away. Love that. A great one is a remake of Lost in Space. Just a fantastic, so much better than the original, where a family stranded out in the universe.
This is not a movie. This
no,
is a TV
it's a,
show.
No, it's a TV show, and
where is it? Where do you find it?
I get them all confused now, but it might have been an Apple. Okay. Apple's, and every episode, the enemy is really the circumstances they find themselves in. They have to figure out in a way that is basically uses, like, real science mm-hmm. To solve a problem. And shows like perseverance, and they don't give up, and they figure, like, how do we kind of MacGyver our mm-hmm. way mm-hmm. out of this problem? Love that. That's a great show, which strong does not jump the shark. And also, I know that you asked for three. I'd also just point out the two most, again, pro progress films, which are The Martian, mm-hmm. Also The Martian book, which I would actually teach in schools, because I think it's very important we have more of that kind of literature in schools. I think some schools are beginning to teach The Martian, where, you know, astronaut stranded on Mars. Again, it's got to, you know, mm-hmm. science's way out of the problem. And Interstellar, great mm-hmm. Chris Nolan mm-hmm. movie. Which shows a world that rejects technology and finds itself in a bit of a fix.
Okay, so I'm not going to ask you for rather than just give me three books, give me a couple books that you've read over your life that you either return to or that you and actually reread, or things that have like, okay, that's an inflection point in my thinking.
Well, I absolutely mentioned the book earlier, which you can probably still find on Amazon, The Third Century by Joel. That is a book I have read sort of over and over, because it remains very timely, and it remains timely again because we're in the 80s. We thought that the Japanese, and what we thought was the Japanese way of having the bureaucrats and the Ministry of Trade figure out which, you know, which industries to support, like that was the way to growth. Now we're sort of going through it again, and in many cases the exact same people from the 80s are still around and saying, no, China's doing it right. They're a little bit smarter. They're a bigger country. They're gonna figure it out. So I think that kind of the message of like the inherent strength of the American system. I would recommend biographies of two people. Let's focus on because reading sort of these old economists is hard. There's a great book called The Profit of Innovation about Schumpeter. Joseph Schumpeter, who came up with the creative destruction, and that in a dynamic economy, businesses will rise and fall, but hopefully then that effect will be to the better. Great, great biography, which I go and I'll page through it over and over. And I always try to remember this one quote. I always screw it up, but it's like that the music of civilization is uproar. I love that, because that there's always going to be change, and if you want a lively, thriving situation, society, like there's going to be uproar, and to ask for anything else is what you're basically saying is, we're giving up, we're choosing stagnation, and I think that's a very different world, and people seem to have a view that somehow that would be a better world, but I'm not sure they actually would want to live in that.
Well, Jim, thank you. This has been fantastic. I knew I would leave this room feeling more hopeful than when I came in, and you haven't disappointed in the least. Look forward to having you back on after you write your next book, which I'm sure will be just as good as this one.
Brett, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Hardly Working. I'm your host, Brent Orrell, and I hope you tune in next time to learn more about the state of workforce development in America. Be sure to like and subscribe to our podcast. Let us know at vocation@aei.org if there are any topics you'd like us to cover. As always, we hope you find the job that fits so well, it feels like you're hardly working.